Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. On this episode of Garden DC, we're talking to April Thompson, Director of Bloom Sales and Marketing, and we're going to explore the world of foraging. Welcome, April.
Thank you, Kathy.
So, you have a full-time job, but one of your passions is foraging, so I wanted to talk to you about that today, but maybe first we'll talk about you and how you got into gardening, how you became the director of sales for Bloom, and maybe a little bit about Bloom.
Sure. Where should I start?
Tell us what Bloom is for our listeners.
I would be glad to. Bloom is what's called a biosolid product, which is essentially a fertilizer that is created from the wastewater stream. So DC Water has actually the largest, most advanced wastewater treatment plant in the world at Blue Plains. And through this process, which is essentially thermohydrolysis, it's like a giant pressure cooker that takes the incoming waste and basically removes any pathogens. It gets dewatered, and the result is this beautiful, slow-released fertilizer that can be used to grow absolutely anything. Hmm.
So some listeners might be familiar with Milorganite. Would you compare the product with that?
Sure. Milorganite comes from Milwaukee, hence the name, and it's been around for around 100 years. So they are in markets all over the country with a bagged product that, is good for lawns and gardens. One of the main differences is that theirs is a heat dry product. So it's highly concentrated because they've removed, most of the water. Whereas with our products, and we have several in our line of products, we have a blend that you can buy from resellers and from Blue Plains. And we also have a bagged product that's the closest to Milorganite. But even though, if you crack open a bag, it seems dry, there's still moisture in that is kind of essentially means that the nitrogen and the macronutrient content, by percentage is not quite as high as Milorganite. But otherwise, you can use it in the same way. You're just going to maybe need more than you would if you're using more concentrated product.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your recommendations for using it as a top dressing for tropical plants, or how would you use it in your own garden?
Sure. And I do use it in my home garden. I actually am a member of a community garden here in Parkview in DC, and I will incorporate that into my garden beds. I also use it on my house plants. I'll just kind of sprinkle a little bit on top. But generally speaking, if you can incorporate it, you're going to have the best result. You want to get, any fertilizer product you're working with, you want to get the nutrients in the root zone where the plant can take that up. Certainly, we have a lot of customers that top dress with it as well, and that works great too. But you're just going to kind of get the best results if you are able to incorporate it, which can be challenging in the compacted soils that we're often dealing with in the area. But that hard work is going to pay off over the long run. And our product works over the long run too. Since it's a slow release product, you'll see the benefits will be reaped over, more than one season, as opposed to a chemical fertilizer that's kind of like a quick fix for your lawn.
Mm-hmm. And I know that people who use Milorganite swear that it's a deer deterrent as well. Have you found that to be the case with Bloom as well?
I have heard that as well. I'm I haven't heard that so much regarding the deer. That's a good question. It does come up, but I'm not quite sure.
That would have to be something that we test out. And how can people get Bloom? Is it something that they can get in bulk, or you had referred to it being bagged as well?
Yeah, it's available in bulk and bag in DC, Maryland, Virginia, both through retailers that are listed on our website, bloomsoil.com, as well as directly from our team, depending on the size and the type of the order. So for example, for bags, we sell them by the pallet. So that's more for, you know, commercial landscapers or resellers. If you're just looking to pick up a bag, you're best off going to our website and looking at the list of retailers. If you've got a big long reno job, you might be best served going through us. Our minimum bulk order size is 15 yards though, so 15 cubic yards. Otherwise, there are other resellers and also blenders who will take our fresh material and then do their own custom blends with that as well. And those are all listed on our website. People can also, you know, reach out to me if they're interested in using it, and I can make a recommendation.
Great. And I know I have a bag that I've been trialing both in containers and my vegetable garden plot. So I luckily don't have deer pressure on either of those places, but I will try it out in a place that does have deer so I can report back on that aspect.
Oh, great. Yeah. And send us photos.
Yeah, hopefully photos of no deer damage. So turning back to you and how you got to be with Bloom, what is your background? And are you a garden geek yourself from childhood, or did you come to it later in life?
Yeah, I definitely am a bit of a garden and nature geek, stemming back from childhood. My maternal grandparents ran a flower shop where I had my first barely paid job, and also had a grandmother on my father's side who was an orchid grower and also very much an avid gardener. And so I definitely think I kind of caught the bug from them and just had an interest from a young age in exploring the world around me. And I can remember, you know, living in a kind of a rough neighborhood of Portland briefly when we were a kid and just roaming the neighborhood. And I can remember coming across these wild plum trees and, you know, just, you know, eating from the plum tree as a child. So I guess my foraging, my interest in foraging really stems back that far, although it's been in recent years that it's really completely captured my time and imagination.
Do you remember ever going out mushroom picking or other type of maybe pick your own places with your family?
Not so much that I can remember. Certainly not mushrooms. That has been something that I've come to on my own, although it's been fun to turn on other people around me to mushrooms. I had a extended getaway with some old friends, and they have two young boys. And this was in Saluda, Virginia, this summer. We all got our COVID tests, and then we all, you know, just piled in for the week. And the knowledge that this 6-year-old picked up just from a week kind of hanging around and looking at things with me was unbelievable. And I sent him a kid's mushroom book when we got back, and his mom says he reads this every night, and they just had their parent-teacher conference, and the teacher said all he talks about is mushrooms. So yeah, it's, you know, people think about it as being a solitary activity, and it can, but it can also bring people together as well.
Mm-hmm. And children of that age are such sponges, and, you know, will soak up all that knowledge that people can share with them. So it's great to mentor children in gardening and, you know, in general, for love of plants.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I have a childhood memory of we were stationed in Alaska for a couple years when I was in preschool and kindergarten age. And I do remember mushroom foraging and going blueberry picking. And I was, of course, terrified the whole time that bears would come because I'd heard about bears. But other than that, had a great time. And that does bring up competing with wildlife for foraging. So maybe we'll jump into some of the do's and don'ts of foraging. And I know some of them are more personal ethical guidelines for a lot of foragers. But I do know that there are several books outlining, you know, how much you should take, what you should take, and what basic principles do you follow?
That's an interesting question, and it's not a straightforward one because, you know, what's ethical is not necessarily legal, and what's legal is not necessarily ethical. There are a lot of plants that we forage that are actually doing the ecosystem a favor to forage because they are highly invasive plants that are crowding out native plants and putting everything in imbalance. A great example of that is garlic mustard, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and kind of runs ragged throughout this area. Rock Creek Park, you'll find it all over the place. This is actually, according to John Callis, who is a forager who's got some great books out there, the most nutritious wild green or green period, wild or domestic, that has ever sort of been nutritionally analyzed. And yet it's terrible for our environment. And I'm not exactly sure, to be honest, where it is native to, but it's not native to here. So forage away when it comes to something like that. Then you take something like ramps that are a more endangered species, and that's something where you want to be very careful. You want to be mindful about over-foraging. There's also ways that you can forage for something like that that does not damage the bulb and allows it to regrow. So, it really depends on the plant. It depends on the place. It depends on a lot of things.
Yeah, and as a weed warrior, we were taught that you can pick enough that you could eat in that one session, but you couldn't strip everything. So they were saying, say if you came across like the wild blueberry bush I referred to, that you could have a handful and then move along, is basically what they were saying for local park rules. Do you know if it's the same rules for national parks, which the federal properties do take up a great deal of Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, technically, for Rock Creek Park, for example, nothing that you shouldn't be taking anything out of the park, period. And this is where legal versus ethical, I have my questions. I will leave it there. But again, you'll find tons of garlic mustard in Rock Creek Park. But if you follow the guidelines, you know, to the letter rather than the spirit of the law, you shouldn't be taking any of that away, period.
And then there's the philosophy that Native Americans have. And I recall Robin Wall Kimmerer giving a talk on that of you should never take the first of one item that you encounter, nor the last. So I thought that was a very interesting philosophy that ensured that there was always something for the next person.
I like that.
And that would be, of course, on properties where you'd had permission to forage.
Right, right. Although if you're talking your own property, then I speak for it.
Yep. Yeah. And she was saying, you know, obviously if it was your own, that you thank Mother Nature or however you envision the bounty of nature being given to you as you're taking those items and then have a purpose for them. And again, they were saying, don't take everything. Yeah, obviously, it won't return back to the land if you take every single one of those ramp bulbs with you.
Right.
And similarly, I was hearing from a mushroom forager, and I don't know if you do this, but they were saying that you should always use a basket to collect mushrooms that has not solid bottom to it. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you're dropping the spores of the mushrooms as you're walking out through the forest, and you're kind of acting like a little mushroom planting fairy. And you were saying before that some things actually benefit from being foraged, and that might be considered one of them.
Absolutely. The caveat I would give there is that often, you know, when you're collecting specimens, you'll also be collecting sometimes some things that you're not sure about, and you need to go home and do a spore print and do more research. Some of those may not be things you want to be spreading because they are poisonous or, you know, parasitic. And this is where it's, you know, the answer is, again, it's complicated because some things that are, you know, wonderful and edible for us are parasitic to, you know, particular trees or even other mushrooms. There are parasitic mushrooms that that parasitize the original mushroom, and then they leave behind something delicious, like something called shrimp of the woods. So nature is complicated, Kathy.
Yep, and that's why we're going to dive in a little bit more into the subject, and maybe let's talk about why one person would forage. So, you know, we have a grocery store down the street. Most of us can readily purchase food at any time. And we're growing our own food, as you said, in your garden plot. So why would you wild forage in addition to that?
Oh, why not is the question for me. But I would say free food, free exercise, medicine. I collect some wild edibles that also have medicinal properties. Really just experimenting with new flavors that you can't buy. There are really some interesting, intriguing things that you can forage. And again, an opportunity to interact with the environment in a really, just a really meaningful and memorable way, and potentially supporting the ecosystem in some of the ways we've touched on. And I would say that the community and camaraderie. I'm a member of some groups that has just been a real portal into another community that I didn't know existed before this.
Hmm. And that's a great point, is the community. So if you're a beginning forager, where would you start? Would you check a book out of the library? Would you sign up for a foraging walk?
Yeah, there are lots of things you can do. And I would recommend diving in any way that kind of strikes you. But, you know, one thing is just start by learning more about some of the common plants that you may already recognize, like dandelions, which are food, medicine, and have a distinction of all parts of the plant being edible. Facebook groups are also great. If you're on Facebook, there's tons of them out there that can help you identify things, that can give you tips for cooking and so forth. Following foragers on social media. And if you can, going out on a foray with someone who knows their stuff is really great. There's someone named Matt Cohen in the area that when I was first getting started, I did a couple of his paid walks. And one of the nice things about that was he would also have some prepared things with a wild food that he would bring along too. So you could kind of taste that on the trail. Guidebooks are great. Apps can be helpful. And Google is also your friend. So, you know, if I come across something or I'm trying to identify something, I will just Google that plant or mushroom, and I will try to learn as much as I can about how to identify it. I will also Google lookalikes, so you can see what other plants may resemble it, so you can help be more confident in your identification.
That's a great point about identification and knowing your plants, obviously, before you try to eat them. And going with an experienced forager can help a lot with that. And were there any mistakes that you made in the beginning on identification that you were, you know, you learned your lesson on, or are there some common plants that people usually do mistake when they start out?
I feel like there's sort of a curve where you start out kind of fearful and then maybe reach a point where you start to feel too comfortable or a little bit cocky, or at least that may happen to some. And then you have a sobering experience that wisens you up. One of the best known forging jokes or sayings is that there are old forgers, there's bold forgers, but there are no old bold forgers, because truly one mistake, particularly with mushrooms, can be deadly. And I don't want to scare people, because it's, you know, there are ways to be sure of what you're doing, but you do need to be 100% sure of the identification of something that you're eating 100% of the time. And I did have a bad experience once out visiting my friend in Denver, and ate a very small handful, I want to say 3 berries maybe, that I was not 100% sure of. And I was very ill for 2 days. So that was my sobering moment. I have not had any bad experiences with mushrooms, but I did discover there are some mushrooms that can have a bad interaction with alcohol, and some that that can be the case with a minority of people. There are also some very choice edible mushrooms that just don't agree with a minority of people. That can be true of some wild plants too. So the rule of thumb is, first time you're trying something, even if you know 100% this is good to go, you want to try a little bit of it before you have more, just to make sure that your system is okay with that. So the mushroom in question was honey mushrooms, which are you know, prolific in fall, and I had successfully eaten them on a few different occasions. And I had these with a good part of a bottle of wine, and my system really did not appreciate that. And I had that with a friend who did not have that experience. We had eaten and drank the same amount of the same thing.
That's a great point, that personal reactions or allergies can be very individual, and you don't know until, of course, that first time you've tasted or experienced something. Trying just one new thing with each meal might help with that, and not doing like a wild green forage salad with, say, 10 different greens, and then you have a reaction to it and don't know what that might be that's in there.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to try one thing at a time. Otherwise, you're really not able to know what did you wrong.
And do you have any favorite spots for foraging in the city? I don't want you to give away all your secrets, but speaking maybe in general, that urban dwellers or inner suburban dwellers might be able to access.
You know, it's funny. People talk about these secret spots. I don't have any secret spots. I don't necessarily even have any favorite spots. This year during COVID, every time I've gone out to forage, I have picked a different part of the park to explore. And I think this year I found well over 100 edible plants and fungi. And I think, you know, part of the, you know, diversity of the things I've found is just kind of going to different nooks and crannies. I guess also I would say, depending on the time of year, you're going to be looking for different types of things. In spring, there are so many delectable wild weeds that, you know, I could eat just from my own city block here. Whereas in summer, you're looking more at wild berries, particular summer mushrooms. And into fall, I'd say that's kind of more of a mushroom season for me. And that's kind of the fun of it too, is that, you know, different things are popping at different times of year, and also different, you know, different parts of the plant may be edible at different times of the year as well.
Yeah, that's really relevant, is the season. And of course, your local location where you refer to not being familiar with the berries in Denver. If you're coming from another part of the country to the Mid-Atlantic or the East Coast, it might be different things that you're foraging for than you are used to or back where you might have foraged before. Or is there something that you really prize, and it might not be something that's rare or anything that like that, but that you're like, yes, I got that this year?
Oh, well, definitely there are some mushrooms that are really prized finds. I found only one, but wild Porcinia, my folks' property in Saluda this year. That was really lovely. I found lots of things this fall. I found a bunch of bluets. That was my first time, and really, really like the flavor of that. Bluets have this beautiful lavender color, although it fades as it ages and gets larger. Mushrooms can be really tricky that way in terms of, which is why things like spore prints can be really important, because two different specimens of the same mushroom can look very different sometimes. So, but that was a good find. Trying to think what else. I know a lot of folks had a really good morel season this year. I found a few, but not many. Those are really delectable mushrooms that come out just for a couple of weeks in spring, right around my birthday. and those are hollow, so you can actually stuff them and do some fun things with them in terms of, you know, culinary experiments.
And how often do you go foraging? Is this something that you do on every walk that you're taking, or do you have specific weekend hikes that you go on?
Every time I am out interacting with nature anywhere, I have my eyes peeled. So, and I'd say there's probably very rarely a day where I'm out and don't find something of some sort. I came across a bunch of wild rose hips the other day. And that's the thing where really your knowledge builds on itself, where, you know, the more that you know, the more that you see that was there all along, but you just did not have the knowledge to be able to identify that plant. But yeah, this season, especially this year, I should say, I've been going out, you know, a couple times a week, probably at least.
Are you preserving a lot of that? Because I know you can get a lot at once of one thing, and then most of the items you want to eat while they're fresh or while they're in the stage that they're the best edible.
Yeah, I'm not doing so much in terms of preservation. I'm not a canner or anything like that. I don't have a dehydrator, although I do use the Pilot Light in my oven to sort of, you know, quick dry some things. I found a ton of Whittier recently, actually, and I foraged, you know, I harvested a lot of it, and I gave it away. I just went on next door and said, "Hey guys, I have a bunch of Whittier." And I was amazed at how many people came forward, because I thought, oh, people are going to be, this is kind of a weird taste, and people are going to be scared to like take a forage mushroom from a stranger. But that wasn't the case. I will do like some pestos from foraged items and freeze that, because that freezes well. Let's see. Also, turkey tail, which is a medicinal mushroom that is, it's very thin, so it's, you know, it's practically dried already, the way that that you'll find it naturally. That is great for medicinal tea, and I will just lightly process that, basically, as I said, drying it in my oven just with a Pilot Light, and then putting it in my spice grinder. It kind of grinds to, you know, almost like shredded newspaper is what it looks like. And then I will just keep that in the freezer until I'm ready to do a tea with that.
Are there any things that you forage for that afterwards you said, eh, not worth it, that takes too much processing, or maybe the flavor afterwards wasn't something that you loved?
Yeah. This year, for the first time, I processed acorns. And that was time-consuming. And of course, it's at a time, the dead of winter, where there's nothing else to be had and nothing else to do, perhaps. So I'm glad I did it. I probably wouldn't do it again, or not for a while. But I did do some interesting things with it, including like a wild acorn cheese. There's a forager, Pascal Baudard, who has some really interesting books and resources out there on wildcrafted fermentation. So I had used one of his recipes. I tried to do like this acorn falafel, but it was just, not, you know, and also, you know, perhaps I didn't do the best job, you know, stripping all the tannins, but that's one thing. I did dandelion wine one year, and that was a heck of a lot of work, just to harvest enough dandelions. And then you have to remove the green bitter part that connects to the petals. And my hands were just cracked and you know, black by the end of that. And I would say the flavor wasn't even all that. But one of those things where I can say I've been there, done that. And honestly, I would encourage people to try everything once, because everyone's palate is different and it's fun. It's fun to, you know, to just do some of these experiments, the process itself. There are also some common weeds that I just find kind of grassy and the flavor uninteresting, considering that there are lots of other really tasty things like plantain, and mallow. Not really a fan of that. But plantain, for example, has medicinal value. So yeah, a lot of these plants do have multiple purposes.
Yeah, and I've heard that story about acorn processing from several people, that it's a lot more calories expended than you get out of it. And then the end result is kind of still bitter, still not that great. But yeah, I think it would have to be, you know, a zombie apocalypse starving situation. And you'd be glad that you knew how to do it, but maybe not worth it.
Right.
So for dandelions, are there any recipes that you have? So you, the wine is a little labor intensive and maybe not worth it, but for the fresh greens in springtime, do you just eat them raw straight in a salad, or do you do any other preparations for them?
Oh, I wouldn't eat them raw just because they are rather bitter. Unless I guess you're mixing them in with some milder greens. I actually just picked some and steamed some today that I'm going to have with some eggs in the morning. That's one of my favorite, you know, simple things just to do is wild greens and eggs. So let's see what else with dandelion. The flowers are also edible, as well as the root. So the flowers you can use in baking. I've done dandelion head fritters, just, you know, fry them up. I've also had them in cookies and things like that. You can also do a tea with it. I'd say with the greens, you know, just I would cook them as you would any other green. And again, just be aware that it does have a rather bitter flavor profile. So if that's not your thing, you know, you might want to pair it with, you know, some kind of sauce that balances that out, or cook it with some other greens.
And how about chickweed, Stellaria media? I'm going to make sure I'm saying the right Latin name for that so people can ID it, because sometimes they get chickweed and henbit and a few of those other low growing things like ground hugging weeds mixed up.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I confess I'm terrible with the Latin for a lot of things. I've picked it up little by little, but it can be important because there can be different plants that have the same common name, and there can be one plant with multiple common names also. So it can get confusing, and the Latin is the great leveler. So Chickweed. Yeah, I have a bunch of chickweed coming up in my garden plot right now, and I'm just letting it go because I think it's just a great salad stuffer, like just to kind of add a little, you know, heft. I don't find it has a whole lot of flavor. It's got a nice little light crunch to it. You could put it on a sandwich like you would some sprouts or lettuce. I had mentioned Pascal Baudard earlier. I did a really interesting fermented spicy chickweed paste that I can't even begin to tell you all that went into that, but that was actually really delicious. So yeah, some of these things are a lot more versatile than you'd realize. And again, Google is your friend. I'll come across something new and, you know, I'll go to my go-to resource books and see how they suggest using it. And then a lot of times I'll go to the internet and see what else is out there.
And it does seem like pesto is always the number one recipe.
It's an easy fallback. And there's so much you can do with pesto in terms of the flavor. I recently did a lemon balm pesto that was really good. I feel like to call it pesto, all you really need is, you know, the oil, the garlic, and some kind of green. And then, you know, beyond that, you can put anything you want. I've added yogurts. Let's see, what else have I done in terms of wild pestos? I'm blanking, but I've done a lot of pesto experiments. And again, it freezes well. And it also is a good way to use a lot of something because it, you know, once you blend that up, it will compact pretty well. So that's also a great way to kind of really maximize the nutritional value that you're getting from something, because obviously you're gonna be using a lot more of that than you are if you're having it in a salad, let's say.
And that brings to mind one of the most expensive elements of classic pesto is the pine nuts. Mm-hmm. Do you ever forage besides the acorns for nuts in the area?
That's a good question. I have not. In my community garden, we do have a forest garden, and we've got some nut trees there. Although some of those I've cracked open and been very disappointed what I found or didn't find. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really done so much with wild nuts. Black walnut is something that you'll find all over the place, and most people don't bother with. I did use that in some bitters that I made. It turned it very, very dark. I've also seen some neat recipes for pickling black walnut when you're kind of getting it earlier in the season. And that's supposed to be really nice for kind of like a charcuterie, offering.
Mm-hmm. And what about herbal uses just for adding like a flavor kick? And I'm particularly thinking of like the little sorrel mm-hmm. weed that pops up everywhere. It's not something I would eat in quantity because it has the oxalates in it, mm-hmm. but maybe something that you would add just a touch of. Are there any favorite flavorings that you have?
Oh, wood sorrel that you're referring to, oxalis. I actually love that. That's one of my favorite little trail snacks because it has that lemony flavor. And I think that's in John Callis's book that has a really simple oxalis soup recipe that I really love. And it was one of those things I was like, I don't know how this is going to be. And definitely had a few of those experiments where I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't make that again. Maybe it wasn't that I wouldn't try that that ingredient again, but I wouldn't prepare it in that particular way. But that's really nice. Also, Virginia pepper weeds, poor man's pepper. It's like Lodosisum Virginiarum. I can sort of like kind of see what the botanical name is, but I can't remember it exactly. Anyhow, that has a really interesting, peppery, like horseradishy flavor. And there you're harvesting the little tiny seed pods in spring. And then you can kind of use that as a condiment. And that's something I guarantee is probably on most people's block here in the city.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of it now. I just Googled it. It's Lepidium virginicum.
Okay.
And Lepidium virginicum. And I can recognize it as the weed that pops up between the sidewalk cracks. And it does have that little tiny seed pouches on the top that burst open. So I can definitely see that it might be a nice nutty flavor from them. And it says it's a member of the mustard family, which a lot of our edible weeds are.
Yeah. Another thing that is an interesting flavor that I think gets overlooked is using pine or other evergreen needles. One of the things I made this year from a recipe from a forager who's got some great books, a cookbook I love. Her name is Mary Viljoen, and she's based in New York City. Anyhow, it was a lemon fir needle or pine needle ice cream, and it was so delicious. And I have done lots of different experiments with evergreen needles earlier this year at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I'd been seeing lately that some chefs were experimenting with pine needles and recipes and mosses of all things. Have you done any mosses?
Ooh, I have not played around with mosses. That might be the next frontier for me.
Yeah, I think the other thing I was seeing was barks that they were making desserts or tinctures or like a foam just with a hint of either a moss or a bark flavoring to them.
Well, you think about it. I mean, cinnamon, we all use cinnamon, and that's the bark of the cinnamon tree. So I guess the thing with bark is that is like the skin of the tree. So I guess you'd have to, I know there are, there's techniques out there to forage for bark that does not damage the tree, but that would be something to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unless it was already something that had been taken down or fell down.
True.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that would be a tough one to make sure on the sourcing for that. And then I wanted to ask you a little bit more about mushroom foraging. So I know that there's a mycology club in the area, in the DC area, that goes on regular hikes together. And of course, probably in this time of COVID, they're a little more careful and use some social distancing. But those are great for being along with the expert to be able to ID mushrooms. Are you a member of that group?
I am. That is the Mycological Association of Washington. And it is a mere $20 a year to join. And you have access to really world-class experts in this. It's right now we are doing virtual forays and virtual monthly meetings. So with the virtual forays, people submit photos of things that they're finding, and then there's a virtual foray leader that goes through them all and helps identify them. And then we have monthly meetings where we've got guest speakers from different parts of the world or country that speak on all sorts of different topics related to mushrooms. So I highly recommend that. I've learned a ton just going out with those folks, although right now there are no in-person forays.
And we have an organization in common, April and I, and that's Knowledge Common DC. And maybe you want to tell our listeners a little bit about that organization.
Absolutely. Yeah. I am a volunteer organizer for Knowledge Commons DC or KCDC, and occasional instructor as well. And have worked with you, Kathy, on a couple of classes. But essentially we are a free roaming school, led by volunteers, taught by volunteers around DC. In normal times, we're holding classes at different community spaces all over the city. That can be parks, libraries, all sorts of different spaces, interesting spaces sometimes. And they're typically short, maybe 1 to 2 hour courses on some quirky topic that some kind of knowledgeable person volunteers to teach. And right now, during times of COVID, we have pivoted online and have been doing a series of online classes, including one I did on foraging. So It's a great and I believe let me look up the website real quick so I can make sure that I'm giving everyone the right.
Yeah, I want to say it's knowledgecommonsdc.org, but definitely check on that. And then I was going to say that I sat in on that foraging talk, and I know that you had a great turnout for that through KCDC. And they've also partnered to do some of the educational programming that takes place every year with the DC State Fair. And that's, I believe, dcstatefair.org as well. And that took place about, 4 to 6 weeks back. And hopefully we'll be coming back in person next year if we can do that again. And did you come up with the website yet?
Yep, it is knowledgecommonsdc.org. And yeah, I know you had done your flower arranging class, which you had taught for KCDC before, and was wonderful. I've taken some great classes from you, Kathleen. My Kokedama lasted a good portion, but eventually went the way of what I think many Kokedama do.
Yes, it is an ephemeral art, but yeah, I've gotten some of them to last a couple years, and that's pretty much the outside for them. And then some I remake halfway through just because the plant inside might outgrow its little moss ball base. And I'll be giving that again this year in January at Brookside Gardens. But of course, because of COVID and social distancing, I think the class is now capped at 8 people and we're holding it in the auditorium. So we'll be greatly distanced. Everybody will have their own big table with another table in between. So yeah, that'll be interesting, but I'm glad that we're still able to at least hold it even at a smaller scale. So that will be fun.
Yeah. Excellent.
And have you taken, I was just going to ask about some other KCDC classes that you might've taken, maybe not non-gardening related that you recommend.
Oh, wow. The hard thing about recommending a KCDC class is mainly do one-off classes. So
yeah.
I've taught foraging a couple times. I know you've done some repeat classes that have been popular, but a lot of them are kind of catch it or else you'll miss it.
Yeah, and they always have such quirky, fun subject matter. A lot of them that I see that I'm like, darn, I'm giving a class during that time, or I would take this one. And I will warn people that when they do come back to being in person, they fill fast.
Like yeah.
I've seen them fill in a matter of minutes. You know, they'll go online at like 8 a.m. on a Saturday, and they'll usually, if you're on the mail list, they'll tell you a day or two in advance it's going to go up, and you better have your finger on that button to sign up for it.
But I'll also say you better be ready to actually come, because
exactly.
I believe is when people RSVP and then take up a space that someone else could otherwise take. And then, I have this class, Cooking Scrappy, that I've done for Reading DC, I've done it for KCDC and somewhere else too, I think. But we had one in-person instance of it, and we had a waiting list, but then many of the people didn't actually show up who were on the original list. So, you know, respect your volunteer teachers' time and organizers with that sort of thing. I know, you know, when it comes to like webinars and things like that, we're kind of all in the habit of just RSVPing for things so that we get the reminder, but in person is kind of different.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially with something with such limited resources and dependent on volunteers.
But the nice thing about, I mean, I feel like there have been silver linings to all that's transpired this year. And one is just that, you know, with things like Knowledge Commons DC, we've been able to reach a lot more people. That that foraging tour that I did, there were, I think, over 100 people that tuned in for that via Instagram Live too, which is a kind of a weird, like, I didn't know if people would actually turn out. So it's nice to be able to, you know, to bring the knowledge to more people than you could in an in-person event. At the same time, you know, you do lose a bit of the intimacy, obviously.
And not being able to actually touch and taste and feel the plant in person.
Of course. Yeah.
It's a little different, but still great to be able to reach many more people that way. And how can our listeners contact you? So if they're interested in, say, joining the Mycological Society or getting links for KCDC or following up to try out Bloom.
Sure. My email for Bloom is april@bloomsoil.com, and you can feel free to email me for any recommendations or questions. Personally, I probably am most findable via Instagram, and my handle is prillytee, that's prillytee, and I also have a website, April Writes. I'm a food writer and do other types of writing. So aprilwrites.com, you can also contact me through that.
Great. And wanted to thank you for joining us today and maybe put you on the spot and ask you for one favorite recipe. And that doesn't even have to be something with forage material, but maybe from your food writing background.
Oh, geez. Let's see. Mushroom bacon, which does not taste like bacon, but is pretty tasty and super simple, and a great way to use up a lot of mushrooms, because mushrooms can go mushy pretty fast, as you know, pretty much anyone who's bought the common button mushroom will know. But you want to thinly slice them, and then. In terms of the flavoring, some type of oil, a bit of soy sauce. I like a little bit of liquid smoke. And then you can add a little of other flavoring, but really you don't need anything else. And then you're going to just sort of mix the mushrooms after they've been sliced in with that, and then lay them out on a baking sheet. And you want to bake it at not a super high temperature. I can't tell you off the top of my head what I did. Maybe, you know, maybe 250 or 300 at the most, for as long as it takes to get them kind of crispy. And the water in the mushrooms, because mushrooms tend to, you know, have a high moisture content, will sort of evaporate, and you're just kind of left with these nice little umami bombs.
That does sound delicious. I think you sold me just with the word bacon there. So thank you again, April.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Plant profile, smokebush. Smokebush is a shrub with many ornamental qualities. It has beautiful foliage, and the airy seed heads look like puffs of smoke surrounding the bush. Smokebush, Cotinus cogigria, is also known as Rus cotinus, the European smoke tree, and Venetian sumac. It is a member of the cashew family. There is an American native version as well, Cotinus obovatus. It needs full sun to put on a real smoke show, but it can tolerate shade conditions. It is a tough plant and needs little care. It is hardy from zones 5 to 8. It can reach up to 6 feet high and wide. Use caution when mowing or working around a smoke bush, as the bark is thin and easily damaged by weed whackers or other garden equipment. It is deer and rabbit resistant. Popular cultivars available include Winecraft Gold with bright golden foliage and Winecraft Black, which has dramatic dark foliage and a dwarf habit. Look in garden centers starting in 2021 for a new introduction called the Velvet Fog from the Proven Winners brand. It has bright pink plumes with blue-green foliage. Smokebush makes a good accent plant in the landscape, or it can be grown in a grouping to form a hedge. It is deciduous and drops its leaves in late fall. It can be trained and pruned to grow as a tree or a shrub. To prune smoke tree, Wait until late winter or early spring and selectively remove entire branches to attain the shape you like. Smokebush, you can grow that. For this week's What's Blooming in the Garden segment, I thought I'd share some of my favorite fall foliage plants. Number one in my garden is the Stewardia pseudocamellia. It's not really known for its fall foliage. You're always looking out for those camellia-like flowers, but this time of year, it is gorgeous. It's kind of a peachy orange color for most of the foliage, which is almost an exact match for my nearby yard flamingos. So I always get some fun out of positioning them together for the color matching and taking a few photos every fall. The next thing I really look out for in the fall is my Fothergilla shrubs. So again, known mostly for their spring flowers, surprisingly beautiful in the autumn. They go from a glowing kind of yellow orange to a burgundy and just a really lovely leaf shades. And then my final personal favorite is ginkgo. They just turn an amazing gold yellow all over, and then you blink an eye and all the leaves have dropped to the ground and you're walking through this just wonderful golden carpet. So look out for local ginkgos in your area, especially like a grove by, say, an office park or a museum or in a public garden that you can watch and check on every few days for that dramatic leaf drop. And then I thought I'd mention a few things that aren't normally thought of at all for fall color, and that's crepe myrtle. So my crepe myrtle, Natchez especially, has a gorgeous deep red color in the fall, and you don't really think of it as a fall color leaf attraction. And then there's my hosta bed, which some of them do turn straight to brown or kind of a sickly yellow, but others, like Paul's Glory, has a really nice seasonal change, and it goes from to a really beautiful gold. And then my final, you wouldn't think about it as a fall foliage plant, are my huge oak trees. Now, some years they do go straight to muddy brown, admittedly, but other years, particularly this fall, they go through a really nice red shade. And they've been hanging on for a little bit and then dropping and looking pretty good. And I think it's that we had a pretty moist late summer into early fall. And that's why this year the oaks are looking particularly good. I hope you get out to a local public garden or park sometime in the next couple weeks to enjoy the foliage of various trees and shrubs. And then, of course, look around your garden and see what you can discover. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter by going to anchor.fm/Kathy-Gents/support. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can become a listener supporter and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Another way to support Garden DC is to go to washingtongardener.com and subscribe to Washington Gardener Magazine.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.